Thanks for listening to Westminster Insider. We'll get started right after this.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This isn't the time for sound bites, but I feel the hand of history on our shoulder. Tony Blair, of course, told TV cameras as he arrived at peace talks in Belfast on the 7th of April, 1998. It was probably the most famous soundbite the man ever delivered, but history was made in the days that would follow. I was three, living just a few miles from where Tony Blair and the Irish leader Bertie Ahern and the political parties in Northern Ireland were all hidden away for days, barely eating or sleeping, in a horrible, smelly building, to agree a settlement that would end nearly three decades of violent conflict. And the agreement they reached on Good Friday, the 10th of April, 1998, would change my life and the lives of an entire generation in Northern Ireland.
An agreement that unites Loyalist and Republican, Unionist and Nationalist leaders in a wide-ranging historical accord.
They've managed to achieve the breakthrough and have people on both sides of tribal divides trusting each other to be in good faith.
The Good Friday Agreement was the beginning of the end of the conflict that we, with classic Northern Irish understatement, call the Troubles, in which thousands had been killed, many tens of thousands injured, and all of society had been scarred.
The police were never in any doubt that this was an IRA bombing.
The Northern Ireland conflict has become a cloak and dagger war.
Somebody once said the trouble with the English is that they never remember, and the trouble with the Irish is that they never forget.
There are people alive today who wouldn't have been if the leaders in that room hadn't chosen peace and compromise 25 years ago. As Tony Blair reminds me in this episode, it's the only successful peace negotiation in the past quarter century of global history. So, 25 years on from that historic, life-changing compromise, this is the story of how they did it. Over the past few weeks, I've been to see Tony Blair in his office in London, Bertie Ahern in his beloved Drumcondra in Dublin, and I've been home in Northern Ireland, speaking to the closest advisers to John Hume and David Trimble, the two late leaders who won the Nobel Peace Prize for their leadership in securing the deal. With their help and the help of lots of other politicians, advisers, and other special people from around Northern Ireland, I'm retelling the story of a historic peace settlement and hearing details and reflections they haven't shared before.
Adams could be very severe in negotiations. I remember one time when he leaned across the table after an all-day session and said, "The thing I like about you, Jonathan, is you blush when you lie."
We were explaining what we were doing to our own base, but we also recognised that we had to convince unionists that their engagement and eventual agreement was the key to getting the IRA to stop.
There is the infamous hand of history moment that evening, which the less said about the better.
He said, "Taoiseach, do you realise you're the only person in the room, as far as we know, that's not a murderer?" It was fairly stark.
And I could see people who had fought the war against each other, tried to kill each other, and were now standing shoulder to shoulder, waiting on the pronouncement.
And they share their views on how Northern Ireland is doing 25 years on.
There is a lesson. In the end, politics only makes progress when political leaders lead. And that usually means persuading your own support of something they don't want to be persuaded of.
So from Politico, I'm Alva Ray. And this week on Westminster Insider, I'm retelling a story of courage, deal-making, leadership, and one hell of a deadline. This is the story of the Good Friday Agreement and what it means today. This is a story of high politics, world leaders, tense negotiations, and historic compromises. But it was all done for real people who were living their lives against a backdrop of terror. So I wanted to start this story not with the men in suits up on the hill in Stormont in East Belfast, but in the living room of Cathy McCann in the small Northern Irish city of Armagh, joined by her friend Betty Spears.
Hello.
Would you like a cup of tea or coffee?
I'd love it.
My father was actually murdered at the beginning of the Troubles in August 1969. I was 5 years old. I remember being lifted up to look into my father's coffin before they put the lid on it.
Cathy's father, John Gallagher, just a Catholic man on his way home from work, was shot dead by the B Specials, an armed part of the police, during street disturbances on the Cathedral Road in Armagh in 1969. He was recorded as the first official victim of the Troubles. But Cathy's story bookends this conflict, and that's how she has a connection to Betty. 21 years after her father was killed, Cathy was in her 20s and working as a social worker. On the afternoon of the 24th of July 1990, she was getting a lift home from Donegal, a county just over the border, from a nun who she knew well.
I walked up, got into the car because Sister Catherine hadn't got out of it, and I remember she said to me, "Well, how are things in Donegal? How's the holiday going?" And I remember to start to tell her about the girls and the antics that were going on, and I remember maybe about a minute of the conversation and nothing else. The bomb happened. I don't even remember saying anything, hearing anything. I was unconscious for several days. I had to be told by my husband that Sister Catherine had died and that three policemen had also been killed in the bomb. And Betty's brother was one of the policemen that actually had been blown up on that day.
An estimated 1,000 pounds of explosives was detonated, killing all four instantly. This is the vantage point from where the IRA gang triggered the device by command wire as the police car approached from one direction and Sister Catherine Dunn from the other, giving her colleague Cathy McCann a lift home.
My father had rang me and says to me, "Could you come in?" Now, my husband was away and I had the two children, and I knew by his voice there was something wrong. And I says, what's the problem? He says, "No, I just want you to come in. I just want you to come in." I drove in the road, and that was the road that the bomb was on. And I was stopped by the police, and he says to me, "You can't go this way." And I says, "Okay, what's happened?" He says, "It was a bomb here." I drove into our yard, and my father met me at the door. And he says, "I don't want you to make a fuss." And I felt, okay. And he said, about my brother, and which when your father tells you something, you respect that. And I went round the side of the house and I kicked the gate with anger. And I just, my brother and I were very, very close. We're a very close family anyway. And I says, "Right." I went in and I went over and gave my mother a hug and my dad. And that was very, very hard for a long time. You just, it's like a void. in the family, you know. It killed my mother and killed my father, definitely. They were dead inside 2 or 3 years.
I was off ill, off sick for 8 months. The doctor had said to me, potentially I wouldn't be able to have any more children because I'd had a head injury in the bomb. But thankfully they did send tests on down to the Royal in Belfast and I was pregnant. We had our second daughter and she was about 7 months old when we emigrated to California. I didn't want to live in Northern Ireland anymore. We had 2 children. I didn't want to bring them up in what I'd grown up in. I didn't want them to have bombs going off every other day and that I wanted to make a new life for us somewhere else. And after 6 months, I was so homesick. It was the best decision I ever made to go to California and it was the best decision I ever made to come back home. And then after that, then the Good Friday talks were ongoing then until the agreement was made.
Just as Cathy came home in 1993, things were shifting under the surface of the conflict, and it was looking, for the first time, like her children wouldn't have to grow up with the violence she had known. We now know that then Prime Minister John Major had begun secret negotiations with the IRA at that time, and in 1994, it announced a ceasefire.
The IRA has announced a complete cessation of all military action from midnight to night.
The IRA believes an opportunity to secure a just and lasting settlement has been created.
Separately, John Major also began peace talks between the various parties, bringing in Senator George Mitchell, a former Senate Majority Leader from the US, as an impartial chair. The talks ended in failure and the ceasefire didn't hold, but it was clear to Tony Blair, then leader of the opposition, that something was stirring in the Republican movement.
Within Republicanism, there was obviously an active debate about how to bring the conflict to an end, because by then they'd recognised that they couldn't bomb Northern Ireland out of the UK, but also I think the UK government realised that a military-only solution wasn't going to work either. Then the whole relationship with Ireland was changing. You know, the British-Irish relationship had been very difficult, very ugly at points for obvious reasons over the years. But we were approaching the end of the 20th century. We were both in the European Union. There was a new relationship. I immediately struck up a good friendship with Bertie Ahern, who was the new teacher. And so I thought there were a whole set of circumstances that gave rise to the hope that reason might prevail, because by then it was perfectly obvious the only reasonable solution was to come to an agreement. It was really then a question of, well, was it possible to find a way through when the distrust between the two communities was so immense?
Blair had a personal connection to Ireland, because his mother was from Donegal. So there was a personal reason and a political opportunity as he saw it. But it was still an extraordinary decision as a new prime minister, leading a party which had been waiting 18 years to get back into power, to prioritise this of all issues.
I had a conversation with John Prescott shortly after I came to power and I said, I'm going to have a real go at this Northern Ireland peace process. And he said to me, what on earth are you spending your time on that for? It's hopeless. They hate each other. And I said, well, yeah, but, you know, we're going to give it a go. And also, you know, I'd appointed Mo Mollam as the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, who was obviously different from anything Northern Ireland had experienced before. You know, they were used to very, you know, archetypal British men really doing that job. And suddenly there was a woman who was very different, very culturally different. And her feedback to me was, no, there is a chance. Mm. And I trusted her political judgment, actually.
And Jonathan Pyle joked that he thinks it's your messiah complex that you want. What did you make of that?
Messiah combat. No, there's only one Messiah and it's not me. So, I did think, look, when you come into government and you come in with a huge expectation, you also come in with a larger sense of possibility. So I guess there was a bit of that in it. Yeah, I think there was a bit of that. And I thought, you know, I often reflected afterwards whether if I tried doing this towards the end of my time, whether I would just have thought, no, that's too much. But anyway, for whatever reason, we gave it a go.
Tony Blair became Prime Minister in May 1997. And a month later, another young, charismatic leader, Bertie Ahern, was elected as the new Taoiseach in the Republic of Ireland.
Tony Blair and I had been working in opposition. I was leader of the opposition down here. He was a leader of opposition in the UK. So we came into 97 and we had both decided that we would make one big effort to try to make this talks process work. And Tony Blair and I had worked out long before that that the only chance really of success in this, the only way to do it was to have everybody in, that the representatives of unionists, loyalists, republicans and nationalists would all be in the talks. And of course, that was easier said than done.
So just to explain Bertie's language here, for those that don't follow Northern Irish politics too closely, unionists want Northern Ireland to remain part of the Union, the UK. Nationalists want a united Ireland. And then within those broad groups, you'll find hardliners who are prepared to use violence. Loyalists on the unionist side and Republicans on the nationalist side. So Sinn Féin, a Republican party, was the political wing of the IRA, and bringing them to the negotiating table was a really hard ask of unionists. The IRA first had to announce a second ceasefire, which it did only weeks after it had killed two policemen. Trust was low, and a lot of unionists wanted another condition attached before they would sit down with Sinn Féin: the complete decommissioning of the IRA's vast stockpile of weapons.
Unionists just didn't believe the IRA were serious about peace, and they knew how symbolically important it would be for Republicans to decommission weapons, and that if they did that, that meant they were serious about changing course and embracing politics and moving away from terrorism.
This is David Kerr, the Director of Communications for the biggest unionist party at that time, the Ulster Unionist Party, or the UUP, led by the late David Trimble.
So we had this episode of, I suppose I could only categorise it as a sort of a crisis within unionism, as what do we do next?
The unionist parties all had to ask themselves if they were prepared to go into talks with Sinn Féin before they'd begun decommissioning, or if they would just walk away. The UUP was seriously thinking of boycotting the talks, but a mood for change was in the air. David Kerr had a momentous conversation with the hardline loyalist David Irvine, who'd served time in prison for paramilitary activities and was now the leading political representative of the UVF, a loyalist paramilitary group.
I proceeded to explain the Ulster Unionist Party's position. And when I had got to the end of my position statement, he just leans forward and he eyeballs me and he says, "What's wrong with you?" And I said, "What do you mean? What's wrong with me? What's wrong with you?" He said, "Are you afraid of these people? Do you think they're better negotiators than you? Do you think they're smarter than you? Do you think they're going to threaten you when you get in here? You know, you're sitting in a room here with me. So why would you not sit in a room with them? What is the problem? You know as well as I know, they could just go out tomorrow and buy some more weapons if they decommission some today. So nothing's going to change, is it? Unless we talk to these people."
The UUP, then the biggest unionist party led by David Trimble, consulted widely on the difficult decision they were facing. Almost universally, they found an appetite for change.
The entire feedback we got from almost everybody was that, yes, you need to go into the talks because we need a political settlement and we need a deal that takes us out of this cycle of terrorism and violence that we've been on for, at that point, for nearly 30 years.
David Trimble led his party into the talks, joined by two other parties from unionism representing loyalist paramilitary groups. But the DUP, led by the hardline preacher, the Reverend Ian Paisley, and another small unionist party, the UK Unionists, refused to join. For the rest of the talks, Paisley and hundreds of his hardline supporters would regularly be outside Stormont, shouting no surrender and calling Trimble a traitor for sitting down with Sinn Féin.
Inside these gates, you have scores of IRA men armed with illegal weapons.
Unionism was already divided, which would be significant when they came to Good Friday 7 months later. Sinn Féin came into the official talks for the first time in September 1997, just 4 months after Blair's election victory. George Mitchell, the US senator chairing the talks, called it a breakthrough.
I believe the prospects today are better than they have been at any time since I have been involved in Northern Ireland, and that is a period of approximately 2.5 years.
And so did Gerry Adams, the leader of Sinn Féin.
I think that it is a defining moment.
Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness were also taking a risk here, as they tried to walk their movement away from violence and towards peace. Now, this question of why the IRA was ultimately prepared to lay down its arms and accept peace without a united Ireland is still one of the most interesting, the most debated, and still partly unanswered questions of the Troubles. Jonathan Powell, Tony Blair's chief of staff and chief negotiator, has his own fascinating view of what Adams and McGuinness were doing. He says that both sides, the IRA and the British state, knew they were in a mutually hurting stalemate where they could each keep going but never win.
I never really properly discussed it with Adams and McGuinness, but they had decided in the mid-1980s they wanted to get to peace, I think, and then they were trying to struggle to find ways to do it. And they also knew that their movement would not necessarily follow them into peace if they just went in a straight line and declared that's what they were trying to do. What they were doing was leading crab-like. They never declared what they were trying to do because what they were trying to do was counter to the constitution of the IRA. So they had to lead people gradually, but they did it very effectively. They had a strategy, they had a way of doing it.
And in fact, fascinatingly, Gerry Adams would say as much to Tony Blair in 1998 on Sinn Féin's first visit to Downing Street.
At the end of the meeting, Gerry Adams took Tony Blair and me to the end of the room behind two pillars, so we were separate from anyone else and they couldn't hear what we were saying. He said, look, I could take some of the IRA some of the pro-Republican movement into a peace agreement straight away, but I want to take time to do this. You're going to have to give me time and space because I'd like the whole movement to do this. And the basic calculation we made at that stage was, okay, instead of trying to divide Republican movement as British governments had done for generations, we're going to actually give this time and space and try and get the whole movement into peace, which I think was important, so you don't have to make peace lots of time. We still have the dissident IRA, but it would have been much bigger if we tried to force the issue right at the beginning. So that, for me, was a very... That's one of the things that gave me some optimism all the way through this process, even when things got very difficult.
Mitchell McLaughlin, the Sinn Féin chairman for most of that period and spokesman during the talks, describes the work they had to do to take what he quaintly describes as his party's constituency with them.
There was also resistance within the Republican community, maybe more than any other party because of the nature of our constituency. We spent a long time doing what became known as town hall meetings. We would call public meetings. We would give updates on the negotiations and political developments. And then we would take questions. In other words, we were bringing our constituency into the discussion and bringing them along with us as we journeyed, through this to eventually what became the Good Friday Agreement and participation in government. I mean, it was fraught. I mean, we were explaining what we were doing to our own base, which was the priority, but we also recognised that we had to convince unionists that their engagement and eventual agreement was the key to getting the IRA to stop. It was extremely painful because you were all the time talking to people whose lives had been impacted, people injured, people killed, family members, you know, that kind of, you know, angst and hurt and you know, agony, getting brought into the room. I mean, we were all talking to victims. But, you know, the British government were talking to victims as well. Everybody was coming in with baggage of one kind or another.
So, sitting around a big square table in Castle Buildings in Stormont, with all of the pain and baggage that Mitchell McLaughlin describes, were Sinn Féin, representatives from the British and Irish governments, and the unionist parties I've mentioned. They were joined by the main nationalist party, the SDLP, and politicians from smaller cross-community parties. Some of them were seeing and hearing Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, the faces of the Republican movement, in person for the very first time.
My colleague who was elected with me to the talks, Pearl Sager, said that she was frightened of seeing Gerry Adams walk into the room.
This is Monica McWilliams, the co-founder of the Northern Ireland Women's Coalition, a smaller cross-community party founded to ensure that women had a seat at the table in the talks.
She'd never seen him before. Her husband was a British soldier, retired. Her cousin, a police officer, had been shot. And she said she couldn't hear his first sentence, that her heart was pounding so loudly that she couldn't hear anything else in her ears. I was, on the other hand, very relieved to see them coming in, because I felt now we've got the ingredients, finally, of making this work.
On the first day of the negotiations, the UUP team were going into Castle Buildings, just as Sinn Féin were coming out, as David Kerr remembers.
It was absolutely horrific in terms of the chemistry between us, because it was guns drawn in a metaphorical sense. We literally hated them, and we knew that they viewed us as almost prey. And they'd killed a lot of our people at that time. So there was visceral hatred.
Incredibly, the UUP never addressed Sinn Féin directly in the talks. If Gerry Adams or Martin McGuinness spoke, it was as though they hadn't heard them. They spoke only through the chair.
It never defrosted. It was always like that. Right throughout the weeks and months leading up to the agreement, there was no love in, there was no defrosting of the relationship. No matter what anybody will tell you, it was not good. It was toxic. But the SDLP, of course, were the largest nationalist party at that time, and they were the main representatives of nationalism. So as far as we were concerned, if we could agree the institutions and the structural nature of the peace settlement with them, we didn't need to speak to Sinn Féin.
Nationalists came into the talks seeking equality to end what most now agree was the unfair treatment of Catholics in Northern Ireland. They wanted equal participation in Stormont, protections to ensure Catholics weren't discriminated against at work, and a reform of the police service, which didn't contain many Catholics at that time and which didn't command the support of the nationalist community. And the main nationalist party was the SDLP, led by the late John Hume, who would go on, of course, to win the Nobel Peace Prize with his unionist counterpart, David Trimble.
The people of Ireland are divided, unfortunately. That's the problem. Now you face up to the problem, or you can wander around having theological arguments about everything else. The problem is that we are a divided people, and the answer is to get agreement.
He was a leader with a profound commitment to peace, who engaged Gerry Adams in talks and thought deeply not just about what nationalists wanted, but about the eventual shape of a peace settlement that would work for everyone. So much of the architecture of the eventual agreement is down to him. This is his former advisor, Mark Durkin, who would go on to be the SDLP's chief negotiator in the talks and, one day, Deputy First Minister of Northern Ireland.
John Hume, as leader of the SDLP, was someone who had put forward an analysis over a period of time that all the past attempts at solving the Northern Ireland problem had failed or would fail because they would ignore one or other of what he called the three sets of relationships. relationships inside Northern Ireland, relationships between North and South, but the island as a whole, and relationships between Ireland and Britain. John's analysis for years was rejected by Republicans, including supporting Sinn Féin, was rejected by Unionists. But as it happened, that analysis became the agenda of negotiations.
So they were off. The talks and the eventual agreement were structured under three strands. Strand one was on relations within Northern Ireland, setting up a democratic assembly and an executive where unionists and nationalists would share power. Strand two would focus on North-South relations between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. Strand three would be on East-West, the relationship between Britain and Ireland. Then there were separate issues like policing, the decommissioning of weapons, and prisoner releases tacked on at the end. Now, they weren't starting with a blank sheet of paper in September 1997. The rock on which the peace would be built was already there from the talks that took place under John Major. That rock was the principle of consent, that Northern Ireland would remain a part of the UK for as long as a majority in Northern Ireland wanted it. But despite knowing roughly what each side needed, it was far from easy, as Tony Blair explains.
The problem was not so much just over the detail, but over this fundamental lack of trust, because both sides thought, well, if the other lot have been completely against the principle I'm supporting here for decades, why should I believe they're going to be any different now? And so the low points really came when I just thought the distrust was too great to overcome.
They made it until Christmas. Then, on the 27th of December, news broke that a loyalist leader, Billy Wright, had been shot in prison by a Republican paramilitary.
Sporadic violence flared in Northern Ireland tonight as a loyalist terrorist organisation pledged to avenge the murder of its leader.
The killing of Billy Wright set off a spiral of violence in the early months of 1998. Loyalist paramilitaries carried out a number of murders of Catholic civilians, and the UDP, who were representing one of the groups responsible, were kicked out of the talks for a number of weeks by the British and Irish governments. Two killings were then attributed to the IRA, and Sinn Féin were expelled by the two governments until the 9th of March.
It is the expectation of both governments that Sinn Féin would be able to return to the talks on the 9th of March. We will maintain contacts with Sinn Féin in the meantime.
Against this backdrop of chaos and violence, the talks were continuing. Mark Durkin from the SDLP remembers how their resolve was strengthened by one high-profile case, the double murder of two friends, one Catholic, one Protestant, by the loyalist terrorist group, the LVF.
Other parties around the table were very strong about not wanting organisations like the LVF to have the last word. So we were united on that, that violence should not trump dialogue. And there was a shared resolve. I can remember, you know, there was a definite new sense of resolve informed by, you know, the public response. And so even in the negotiations and the talks that took place that week, while we were still arguing bits and pieces about each other's preferred model, those exchanges were less rhetorical and a lot more practical and measured.
Sinn Féin was readmitted to the talks. After hundreds of days of negotiating, they weren't much closer to an agreement. The two governments were running out of patience, and George Mitchell, who had a newborn baby at home, was keen to leave soon. As any journalist would understand, what was needed was a deadline.
We were arguing at the time, this needs a deadline, and George Mitchell would say to us, I'm Humpty Dumpty, I can jump only once. And if I get it wrong, there's a mess. It's okay for me, I'm out of here. You guys are left to clear up.
On the 25th of March, George Mitchell publicly set a date.
And he says, as much as I like you all, I'm fed up with this. And we've been kind of kicking these issues around now for 2 years or nearly 700 days. So he's completely fed up. And he sets a deadline on the 25th of March of the 9th of April. So he says, I'm giving you until Easter Thursday, I think it's called, the day before Good Friday. And if you don't have a deal by then, I'm out of here. I'm going home.
They knew it wasn't a bluff. And everyone in all of the parties knew what the cost would be if they failed.
If this actually collapses and the whole thing unravels, people will die. And that's not me just being, you know, flippant about that. People would die.
Every time peace talks had collapsed in Northern Ireland before, there was a renewed cycle of violence and terror, often worse than what had come before. They all knew it was now or never. Stay with us.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Monday, the 6th of April, 1998. It was the final week of negotiations, and it didn't start well. Days later than planned, the British and Irish governments had managed to produce a draft agreement, but when David Trimble's Ulster Unionist Party saw it, they were furious.
Our gaze hit the roof. The message is sent back to Blair that evening, look, this is never, ever going to wash with us.
As David Kerr explains, the arrangements on Strand 2, or in other words, on the relationship between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, were so bad for unionists that they were considering walking away.
Our Strand 2 team looked at it within seconds. They just said, what is this? This is an aberration. The intention of Irish Republicans and the Irish government was at all times, we felt, to create North-South institutions that would effectively, in time, evolve into all Ireland institutions of government. And our view was, we'll never accept that, because that effectively then is, you're into a united Ireland at that point. We go into Tuesday. Trimble phones Blair on the Tuesday morning and says, this is actually now so bad, if you don't do anything about this, you know, we're going to have to say no to the whole thing.
They wanted Tony Blair to fly in from London and try to fix it. But in Downing Street, he was getting advice that the whole thing was looking so hopeless, it might be better politically to stay away.
So there was quite a lot of disagreement about whether it was worth me going or not. But I decided I would go anyway. My strong instinct was that it was now or never, because the elements to go into the agreement weren't going to change. The parties weren't going to change. So I didn't think time was going to improve the situation. I thought the only thing that would change it was my own engagement in it and just deciding, okay, we're going to, let's dig deep into the details and see if we can start to turn it round.
Blair travelled to Northern Ireland with his spin doctor, Alistair Campbell, and his chief of staff, the former diplomat, Jonathan Powell.
So when we flew into Northern Ireland for the Good Friday Agreement, we'd agreed Tony wouldn't do any media. And we got in the helicopters and then swept up to Hillsborough, the front door. Went to the front door, there were millions of cameras in that lobby of the front door. So we went through and Alistair said, I think we had to do some media. And so we just pushed Tony Blair straight back out again to the cameras without giving him a chance to think. And he went straight to the cameras and he said,
a day like today, I mean, it's not a day for sort of sound bites, really. We can leave those at home, but I feel that I feel the hand of history upon our shoulder.
Perhaps the most famous soundbite he ever made. And Alistair and I were doubled up in fits of giggles at this contradiction between this is, you know, in these sort of very tense situations, you also have a certain gallows humour. Perhaps the greatest soundbite came out of not having a chance to think about what you're going to say.
When I got there and arrived in Belfast, then I remember Senator Mitchell saying to me, "I think this is hopeless." It had completely broken down.
Mitchell, in fact, feared the talks were at the point of total collapse over these North-South institutions. Here's the unionist, David Kerr.
I am sent upstairs to tell George Mitchell that we are about to publicly reject the document, because at that point we hadn't actually formally rejected it. I do that, I go to see George Mitchell, and George comes out to meet me at the door of his office, and he's trembling. I can still see him literally shaking in front of me, because I think he thought I was about to tell him we were out. So I don't think I ever saw George Mitchell as stressed looking in my life as I did in that moment. So the message was delivered. We weren't going to accept the document, but we weren't walking away.
Tony Blair decided he had to start again. He rolled up his sleeves, dug into the detail, and sat down with David Trimble, who produced a long list of major changes he wanted. Blair was prepared to give Trimble what he needed, but it would be up to Bertie Ahern and the Irish government to decide how much they were prepared to give away. And Bertie Ahern and David Trimble hadn't always had the warmest relationship, as Jonathan Powell remembers from one tense meeting.
Bertie did lose his cool and looked like he was going to punch David Trimble in the mouth, but luckily we restrained that.
So Bertie Ahern was under pressure, and he was under strain for another reason too. His mother had died on the Sunday night, and Tuesday evening was the night before her funeral in Dublin. Over the phone, George Mitchell told him he had to come back to save the deal in person.
He said, "The only way you can do this is, in spite of the fact it was my mother's funeral on the Wednesday morning at 12 o'clock, was for me to go up at 7 o'clock, meet Tony Blair in Hillsborough, kind of get it, renegotiate with him, and then go maybe for 9 o'clock and meet the unionists, get that sorted out with them, meet the other parties for an hour, and then get back to Dublin."
Ahern left the talks to go to his mother's funeral. He was at his mother's graveside when officials came up to remind him that he was due back in Belfast in half an hour. He met me at the same hotel, the Skylon, in Drumcondra in Dublin, where the funeral party came after his mother's burial.
I just had time to come back and say to them, "Oh, thanks for being at the funeral," and then go back to Belfast. So it was, I remember that morning, but I had to get back quick.
Bertie Ahern flew back to Belfast, where journalists put down their cameras to recognise the personal sacrifice he was making. And coming into Castle Buildings, he bumped into David Kerr from the unionist side he was about to negotiate with.
And he looked absolutely awful, as you would expect him to look in the circumstances. He goes upstairs, prepares his people, and then the negotiations start in earnest that night with the Ulster Unionists to resolve Strand 2. So they discuss that into the wee hours of Thursday morning, and they get agreement.
Weighing on Bertie Ahern's mind was the violence that would erupt if the talks broke down. So he changed his position. He and the Unionists slimmed down the North-South proposals and agreed that those all-Ireland bodies would only sit if Stormont was sitting, alleviating those concerns that David Kerr had of the stealth creation of a united Ireland. As so often in this extraordinary story, this is a tale of human moments, personal relationships, trust and goodwill.
I was only one person, but unfortunately they all decided that they wouldn't move forward unless I was there. So that's how all the hassle happened to me, having to be running back and forward, you know. But anyway, as it happened, there was no alternative. Sad to do it.
And it was a bit of a personal
sacrifice then?
Yeah, it was. But listen, you know, in the week that was in it, we've been working on this week for months. I just remember saying you had to do it. Luckily enough, because I think they did appreciate that I did it. So when I came back on the Wednesday evening, we did get momentum into the talks. There was no doubt about it.
Had Bertie Ahern not taken charge of that situation because his officials weren't going to budge and his foreign minister at that time, David Andrews, wasn't going to budge, they had this wish list and they were determined to dig in and hold on for dear life to see if they could get it, but it was never going to work. So huge credit goes to Bertie Ahern for that.
Because he moved.
He moved massively towards us.
In the early hours of Thursday morning, the day of the deadline, the UUP was finally happy. But that wasn't the end of the difficulties. These negotiations were happening on a knife edge. Tony Blair describes it as like balancing a seesaw.
As anyone's been on a seesaw knows, it's very hard to get it to balance, right? And that was the problem through the negotiation. Because of the distrust, you would literally have a situation where you'd be in a meeting with one side and the other side would be waiting outside. And if the people you'd had the meeting with went out looking happy, the other people came in looking sad. I mean, so it was the psychology was, let's say, complicated.
And these tense negotiations were all taking place in less than ideal surroundings.
It's important to remember that Castle Building itself was a character. It was this ghastly building with sick building syndrome, smelt of sweat and stale food, and people had been there for months when we got there for the Good Friday negotiations. It was awful. So in a way, that was the dominating character of the whole negotiations.
Castle Building sounds horrible.
It was horrible, yeah. But I never knew whether that was an advantage or a disadvantage. A disadvantage because it was a horrible building, or an advantage because everyone wanted to get out of it.
Thursday. No sooner had the unionists been reassured and progress made than rumours began that Sinn Féin might walk away. Mo Molam, the late legendary Northern Ireland secretary, decided to negotiate with Sinn Féin directly. She, of course, was in the middle of treatment for the cancer that would eventually kill her, so she was wearing an intravenous drip and she'd taken her shoes and her wig off. She ignored a lot of Sinn Féin's suggested changes and honed in on one, the difficult issue of the early release of prisoners, people serving, in many cases, life sentences for murder. For Sinn Féin and the Loyalist parties, these were political prisoners who should be released with the peace deal.
We hadn't focused on this aspect about prisoners at all. And when Mo Molam came in, I remember, and telling us, you know, we're going to have to let prisoners go after 2 years, and we were sort of really taken aback. How are we going to sell that? No, we thought this was going to be really, really difficult. We didn't know if this was possible. And we got a guy called John Steele, who was the senior Northern Ireland official on security, and we got him to come and brief us on this. And he said, look, this is going to be very difficult with the unionist community, but you won't get an agreement without this. This is what you're going to have to do. So we bit the bullet, so to speak, and actually decided to go ahead with that.
The British government had agreed the principle of prisoner release, but it still wasn't enough. As evening approached on the Thursday, you can imagine the kinds of characters from the Republican movement who were coming in to meet Adams, and it looked like the deal on the table still wouldn't be enough for them.
I did an interview on behalf of the party.
Mitchell McLaughlin came out to speak to the waiting press.
I was the main spokesperson. So I came out to talk to them at 7 o'clock the night before to say that we were making very, very little progress on key issues, including things like prisoners' release, including things like guarantees on protections for the Irish language.
So in the early hours of Good Friday, Gerry Adams came to see Tony Blair with a difficult message.
Gerry Adams came to see Tony by himself and said, look, I'm going to need this to be 1 year. If it's 2 years, I don't think I can get this through.
For a sleep-deprived Tony Blair, this was just one more nightmarish issue to grapple with.
To be honest, the days sort of blurred into each other, and I think we got about 4 or 5 hours sleep in the whole 3 days. So I can't remember exactly when it was that we had the discussion about prisoner release. it looked like that was kind of essential to get people on board. And it was always going to be the case that once you decide, and this is always the difficulty with the peace process, once you decide that you're going to end the conflict, then, you know, what do you do about the people who've been combatants within that conflict? So it was always going to be difficult.
Blair had developed an unlikely but strong working relationship with Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness by this stage.
This is a very difficult thing always to say in the context of Northern Ireland, because people, if you're a unionist, you can often resent any compliment being paid to the Sinn Féin people. But the truth is they were thoughtful people, and they had a capacity to think strategically. And so you could, you know, disagree strongly with all the things they'd done in the past, but in the end, it was clear, you, at least it was clear to me, I was dealing with two people with whom you could have a serious strategic conversation, and that's the most important starting point.
And also remember, Adams and McGuinness are leaders of a covert organisation. They're used to hiding not just their emotions, but all sorts of things. Adams could be very severe in negotiations. I remember one time when he leaned across the table after an all-day session and said, "The thing I like about you, Jonathan, is you blush when you lie." And Bill Jeffrey, the Northern Ireland civil servant sitting next to me, leaned back across the table and said, "Unlike you, Gerry." So it was an experience to negotiate with them, but I didn't actually find them intimidating. I sometimes find it quite painful, but not necessarily intimidating.
Tony Blair told Gerry Adams that prisoner release after 1 year wouldn't be possible. But in those wee hours of Good Friday, they struck an unwritten deal.
And they agreed in the end that Adams would come back to us later if it was really, really difficult to sell this to the rest of the Republican movement, and asked for the 1 year. In fact, he never did.
We were still engaging with the parties up until 4:30 in the morning of Good Friday. 4:30. We then retired to our own room.
Mitchell McLaughlin, Sinn Féin spokesman.
And we then worked through our checklist to see what we had achieved, what we were satisfied with, what would remain, work in progress, and so on and so forth. On the basis of that, it was decided that we'd stop the engagement, we would take a few hours sleep, and then we would rerun the exercise at dawn the following morning. As it happened, we started about 6:00. And then on the basis of that, at 7:00, I was authorised to come out on behalf of the party and indicate that we believed that we had sufficient in the package to really make the deal work.
As the sun rose on Good Friday, Sinn Féin came on board. The parties had passed the midnight deadline and the teams were all exhausted. They knew that it was all meant to be over, and they waited in their rooms for word from the chair of the talks, George Mitchell. Monica McWilliams again.
Around 11:00, we got a memo to say, "This is the last memo you will receive from the chair, and I want you to know that it was a pleasure working with you all." And I thought, what a nice thing to do. And then the next 5 hours, it was nothing, because we knew Ulster unionists were having enormous difficulties.
Most of us were there all of the Thursday night.
David Kerr from the UUP again.
So I slept on a chair for about an hour. Most of us stayed there. David went off to get a few hours sleep in a hotel nearby. He comes back and you can feel the tension rising at that point within our team, because here we are. We've actually secured all the constitutional strategic objectives for unionism that we set out to achieve. And we have these three issues now of prisoners, arms, decommissioning and policing sitting here. And we just can't get terms on those three issues that we know are acceptable to all of our talks team and to wider unionism. So we have this judgment call to make.
David Trimble called a meeting of his party, the UUP, to make one of the biggest decisions unionism had ever faced. They piled into an empty office and tensions were rising. Trimble didn't say much. He invited them one by one to state their view.
So then Jeffrey speaks, and Jeffrey Donaldson is clearly very emotional about it.
That's Geoffrey Donaldson, who's now, of course, the leader of the DUP.
It's obvious Donaldson is in real difficulty. Prisoner releases, he views this as completely immoral. He then goes on to decommissioning, and he says the language around the requirements for decommissioning before Sinn Féin get executive office are too woolly. He then talks about policing, and he says, this is just an open-ended commission into the RUC.
The agreement contained a plan to review the RUC, the police service, to ensure it could command the support of both communities in Northern Ireland and not just unionists.
We all knew what he was saying on those three issues was probably right, and we kind of all agreed with him. But here we were sitting with this situation where, as I've explained, we've effectively hit all of our strategic constitutional objectives in the negotiations. And we've these three issues that are being bolted on to this deal that none of us like, but we have to weigh the whole thing up.
But the next to speak was Ken McGuinness, a veteran UUP politician. What he would say would stay with David Kerr forever.
The IRA had tried to kill Ken on nine separate occasions at that point. So Ken says, you know, basically, look, guys, I've been at this now for 30 years and I've seen everything and I've seen it all. What I do know is that every time there's a failed talks process, there's a renewed cycle of violence. So he says, we've come into the talks to secure these constitutional objectives. We wanted the consent principle enshrined in law. We've got everybody to accept that. We have North-South cooperation set up in a manner that doesn't threaten unionism. We've got Articles 2 and 3 removed. We have got Stormont back, effectively, under this arrangement. But what we have to do is, as a talks team, is we have to weigh this up. Is the glass half full or is the glass half empty? And we also have to be cognizant of the fact that if we don't take this deal, if we don't bank this deal, there's a very good likelihood that the two governments will ultimately do a deal over our heads anyway.
Ken McGuinness had made the case for swallowing the deal, however painful. But David Trimble was under immense pressure. Geoffrey Donaldson walked away, followed by Arlene Foster. And Ian Paisley and his supporters were still outside.
We say never! Never! Never!
Over in Tony Blair's office, he worried the whole deal was slipping away.
At that stage, Tony Blair decided that we had to have a side letter to David Trimble to keep him on board about weapons.
Jonathan Powell, Tony Blair's chief of staff and chief negotiator.
Because we couldn't reopen the agreement now at that stage without losing the whole thing on the decommissioning of weapons. So we sat down, I had a laptop, and Tony dictated to me what we should say. We had John Steele, the security official, with us, who was sort of amending it as we went along. I typed it up as fast as I could on the laptop, pushed print, got a copy, ran downstairs, and they wouldn't let me into the unionist room. I knocked on the door, but they wouldn't let me in. I stuck the letter under the door. And then eventually a young guy opened the door and let me in. I went up to the table, gave the letter to David Trimble, who had John Taylor sitting next to him. John Taylor looked over his shoulder and said, yep, that will do.
And we opened the letter, and the letter basically said, dear David, if decommissioning from the IRA doesn't happen straight away, I will support changes to the legislation after 6 months to make decommissioning happen. And of course, we knew the letter was probably not worth the paper it was written on. We knew who we were dealing with. But again, that was as good as we were going to get. And we knew that. So we had to make a call on it. And whilst we all, I think, accepted within the room that Blair's letter would not be honoured by him, for the moment, we would bank the constitutional gains and we would take it from there.
At 4 p.m, Bill Clinton rang Trimble to encourage him to do the deal.
That was comforting and that was nice. It's not, and I'm trying to be as diplomatic as I can, it's not ultimately the thing that swings the decision. David Trimble had made his strategic mind up, I think, earlier on the Friday. His view was their short-term problems,
the bigger picture long term for unionism is that this is actually a very good deal for unionism. And if we can make the institutions work, Northern Ireland will stay in the UK for as long into the future as any of us can see. He rings George Mitchell. He then comes in to the main Ulster Unionist talks, and he stands up on a chair, I think. He got up on a chair and he said, look, I'm going to go upstairs now, and I have decided we are going to support the agreement. Anybody who wishes to join me upstairs is more than welcome to do so.
George Mitchell opened the plenary session at 5 p.m. Good Friday.
I remember being very serious about saying those words, I am in favour.
This is Monica McWilliams.
I was the third party out of eight as he went round the table asking for a declaration. And I was probably very proud of the fact that I was representing the party that had the only woman at the table to make that declaration. Behind me, I suddenly glanced and I could see people who had fought the war against each other, tried to kill each other, and were now standing shoulder, waiting on the pronouncement. That is it. I now declare this peace agreement is done.
I will say to people, it's very rare in politics you get a moment of unalloyed joy, and this was one of them.
A historic day at Stormont. After 2 years of talks and after a generation of bloodshed and decades of division and acrimony, George Mitchell ushers in what the whole island hopes will be a new era of peace.
The settlement received an enthusiastic welcome from across the political spectrum and from abroad.
After a 30-year winter of sectarian violence, Northern Ireland today has the promise of a springtime of peace.
There was praise for the Taoiseach and for the parties from Tony Blair, who paid tribute to all who had lost their lives in the conflict, suggesting that the nature of today's deal would change relationships in Northern Ireland forever.
Tony Blair flopped onto a plane, exhausted, days late for his next engagement, a summit with the Spanish Prime Minister. En route, he took a phone call from the Queen, congratulating him. Bertie Ahern arrived back into Dublin to TV cameras and crowds of people cheering. On his way back from the airport, he passed his mother's house, but she wasn't there. So much had changed in those short few days. Now it was up to the people. Within days, everyone in Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland had received a copy of the agreement to decide how they would vote on it in a referendum. I'm sitting here with my dad's copy. This agreement is about your future, it says on the front cover. Please read it carefully. Inside it begins, we, the participants in the multi-party negotiations, believe that the agreement we have negotiated offers a truly historic opportunity for a new beginning. Cathy and Betty and everyone on the island of Ireland had a decision to make. But Betty hadn't watched those historic developments on TV on Good Friday.
To quite honestly, I avoided. I felt it's not going to change my situation.
I remember laying out in our back garden reading the Good Friday Agreement. And I remember thinking, is this what I want? And I thought, do I want my children to be brought up in a world where there's going to be bombs and explosions and horrific news stories every time you put the news on or you open a newspaper? And I said, no, I don't want that. If that means that these men are going to be released under the terms of Good Friday Agreement, can I live with that in the scheme of things? And I thought, yeah, I can. I want to vote yes. Unlike Betty, yes, I watched it. I watched them coming out and I watched them making the announcement. And to be honest, I really did feel elated about it.
Betty also decided to vote yes.
It took a lot of thought and I wanted to make the right decision. And I suppose that there's a lot of mixed emotions going on in my head. But if I took the negative attitude, things were not going to move on. and get better. So it had to be done.
Yes, 71.12%.
Yeah! 25 years on, so much has happened. And unless you've been living under a rock, you'll know that this Good Friday Agreement anniversary is prompting big conversations about where Northern Ireland is now, about the impact of Brexit, about a crisis within unionism, about whether there'll be a border poll and United Ireland soon, and whether parts of the agreement should be rewritten. Bertie Ahern and Tony Blair are proud that 25 years on, the peace has largely been maintained. But they both say they're disappointed that Stormont is currently sitting empty, as the DUP refuses to re-enter over the Northern Ireland Protocol. Power sharing has been collapsed so many times since the Good Friday Agreement now, that some are calling for the agreement to be modified so one party can't pull down all of Northern Irish democracy. And Bertie Ahern is notably supportive of using the review clause in the agreement to do just that.
I don't feel as happy about the institutions. I mean, I think it's crazy, quite frankly, that institutions where people are elected to function and to run the administration and run the health and education environment, that they're down more often than they're up. I think it beholds all of the politicians today, in whatever review takes place in the future, that they find mechanisms that people can't be pulling down parliamentary institutions. You know, that you shouldn't be doing that. You shouldn't want to do that. Your children wouldn't go on like that. You know, you have to sort these things out, you know.
But how long will it be before Northern Ireland has something resembling normal democracy?
Now, I would love to see the day, but it's not yet, in my view, where you have a government and opposition working. But I think I don't think we're at that stage yet. I think you need to have a sustainable period of where people are working together before you can do that.
To people who knew Northern Ireland before and after, the change has been dramatic.
Tony Blair again.
I know there's still a lot of change still to happen socially, economically and politically, but at least we've got a chance of doing it and doing it in an atmosphere of peace. And the relationship between North and South today is, again, completely different. So all of that, I think, is important, but it's still fragile and you need to protect these things the whole time. But probably this is the only successful peace negotiation in global history, actually, for the last 25 years, virtually.
Is there a lesson for our current crop of political leaders in Northern Ireland from that time?
Yes, there is a lesson, and it's a lesson in political leadership, and that is that, in the end, politics only makes progress when political leaders lead. And that usually means persuading your own support of something they don't want to be persuaded of. And instead of playing to the gallery, being prepared to look at the genuine interests of the people you represent.
So it's someone like Geoffrey Donaldson not really leading from the front?
Well, Geoffrey can, and this will be a test, because, you know, to be absolutely blunt about it, the Northern Ireland Protocol is the best agreement you're going to get. And you need stability to return to Northern Ireland to protect the union. So if you're a unionist, stability is your friend. That's why we created the Good Friday Agreement.
But those who paid the heaviest price for the peace were the ones who had already suffered the most. Cathy's biggest fear was meeting the man behind the bombing she'd been in, the one that had killed Betty's brother. And on the very day he was released from prison, Cathy saw him.
I was in a local dress shop, and one of the gentlemen who had been released just, I would say, about 1 hour, 2 hours previously, was there with his daughter. He looked over at me and he winked and said, "Well, Cathy, how are you?" At that stage, I lifted my daughter by the hand, right? I couldn't speak at all.
In the years since, Cathy and Betty one Catholic, one Protestant, both profoundly impacted by the Troubles from different sides of the community, have worked together with Wave Trauma Centre, a cross-community victims charity. They are friends, and they sit alongside ex-paramilitaries.
My reason for voting for the Good Friday Agreement is for us to live as a community and for to go to Wave. I knew I was going to be meeting people from all denominations, and potentially there was going to be people, because within Wave, you could have been the person who planted the bomb, or you could have been the person who's affected by the bomb. And was I happy with that? Yes, because that was part of what I was voting for under the Good Friday Agreement.
So I'm here in the heart of Belfast, the heart of my city, outside Queen's University Belfast, the beautiful red brick building just south of the city centre. Of course, in just over a week, world leaders will be here, Joe Biden, Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, who's Chancellor of this university, Rishi Sunak, all the big players who we've been hearing from in this episode. We'll all be here to mark the 25th anniversary of that agreement. Belfast is very different now, full of tourists, full of expensive bars and art galleries. And it's very beautiful, which lots of people don't realise, surrounded by hills on all sides. But I'm actually just nipping right across from Queen's to the independent cinema called QFT, Queen's Film Theatre. And I'm going to meet someone for whom the anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement means something a wee bit different. She's coming from her city of Derry to meet me in mine here. Hiya.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Sorry, I'm a bit late.
Don't worry at all. Nice to see you.
You too.
Across the way, we've got Queen's and in about a week, we'll have everyone, all the big names here for the Good Friday Agreement anniversary. Mm. But that anniversary means something a bit different to you.
It does, yeah.
Lyra McKee was shot dead by dissident Republicans in Derry on the 21st anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement. This is her partner, Sarah Canning.
On Holy Thursday, which for the non-Catholics out there is the day before Good Friday, in 2019, my partner and I went to watch a riot in Derry. Her name is Lyra McKee, and she was shot by the new IRA. It wasn't a targeted attack. They brought him in at the police, who were in a Land Rover that we were standing beside. But unfortunately, Lyra bore the brunt of that, and she died that day.
And you were there with her?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was beside her.
Let's now go to Northern Ireland, where police are blaming a dissident Republican group for the shooting death of a journalist last night.
She was of a new generation of people in Northern Ireland that viewed themselves as from Northern Ireland, but not Protestant, not Catholic. For her to die at the hands of a sectarian murderer, at the hands of a terrorist, I think is a horrible, dark irony.
Lyra McKee's older brothers carried the coffin, while the Belfast crowds gave their applause for a young journalist killed doing her job.
I commend our political leaders for standing together in Craigan on Good Friday. I am, however, left with a question. Why in God's name does it take the death of a 29-year-old woman with her whole life in front of her
Like me, Lyra McKee was a ceasefire baby, one of the generation who were meant to reap the rewards of the peace. But the thread that ran through all her journalism was asking whether the promise of the Good Friday Agreement had really been delivered on. She looked at the suicide rate, intergenerational trauma, the lack of job opportunities for young people, a lack of truth and justice for the victims of the Troubles, and, crucially, She shed a light on the grim reality of the hold that paramilitaries, like the ones who would kill her, still have in certain communities in Northern Ireland. And that's work that Sarah continues.
I mean, I think it's important for people, especially at the minute, to be aware of the realities of what happens when violence like that breaks out. You know, sometimes it's all fun and games, or it seems like it. It's just a riot. It's just bricks. It's just bottles. It's just the odd petrol bomb. But the reality is, you know, when someone takes it that step further and brings a gun onto the streets, then what you have is the potential for serious injury or loss of life. And I was born in 1983. I lived through a lot of the troubles, and it took until 2019 for the troubles to actually hit me in the worst way possible, when I saw the person I loved shot in the head. And I went to administer first aid to her, and I saw the absolute devastation that bullet caused to her skull, and I felt her life ebbing away under my hands when I tried to administer first aid. And that's something that, like, thousands upon thousands of people in Northern Ireland can relate to, and further afield. But there's a lot of youngsters now who are hearing all the glorification of the old days, and they're not aware of the realities. Lyra was really interested in the fact that, you know, the violence never went away. It wasn't as big as it was previously. It wasn't as violent as it was previously. It became internalised within our own communities.
In some of the most deprived communities in Northern Ireland, gangs that still hide behind a flag and justify their actions in the name of loyalism or republicanism maintain a hold. They are condemned universally by our political leaders, and they're technically illegal, but they're still in existence. While I was home last week, the terror threat in Northern Ireland was raised to severe as we head into the Good Friday Agreement anniversary.
And Lyra and I think, pretty much the same age, so both ceasefire babies, yeah, as she would have put it. And one of the things that she looked at, I mean, there's this thread running through all her journalism, sort of scrutinising whether the promise of the Good Friday Agreement had really been delivered on, who was reaping the rewards of the peace. She uncovered this statistic that it was something like just as many people had died by suicide since the Good Friday Agreement had died in the Troubles.
One of the things that Lyra talked about was the fact that our generation, or her generation, and my generation, I'm a bit older than Lyra, and the generations coming up, we were supposed to reap the rewards of this peace. You know, there were supposed to be dividends that came down, and they didn't appear for everyone. You know, the poorer areas are still suffering, and they're not seeing the rewards that we were promised. So the Good Friday Agreement was a massive achievement, and on paper, it's fantastic. But I also think that she would be calling out the fact that, you know, we are coming together, and there's going to be a lot of backslapping and celebrating about something that was achieved 25 years ago. And I don't think there's anything wrong with acknowledging the wonderful moves that were made then, but I do think there's something wrong with still congratulating yourself 25 years on when so much of it hasn't been fulfilled. We've had a degree of peace, but the peace that we expected and the peace that we received are two very different things. We were promised prosperity, and we were promised that our children would stop dying, and that hasn't happened either. You know, Lyra is the 160th person who's been murdered by paramilitary since the start of the Good Friday Agreement, which is an insane number. I know it's 25 years, and when you look at the preceding 25 years, it was thousands. But, you know, in peacetime, we should be looking at numbers at zero. And zero is really the only acceptable number.
So much was changed by the Good Friday Agreement for people of my generation. But we shouldn't forget that Northern Ireland is still a fragile post-conflict society. So as the politicians gather in Belfast this month to rightly celebrate that extraordinary agreement, let's hope they remember the name of Lyra McKee and all the others who've died since April 1998, as they work to strengthen that peace that was so hard won. Thanks for listening to Westminster Insider with me, Alva Ray. If you've enjoyed it, please spread the word, follow us, maybe leave us a nice review. And don't forget you can listen to past episodes, including my Victims of the Troubles episode from last June, which looks at an important gap at the heart of the Good Friday Agreement. Thank you to everyone who spoke to me for this episode, especially Cathy McCann, Betty Spears and Sarah Canning. And Lyra, the film about the late Lyra McKee, is on Channel 4 and All 4 on the 15th of April at 9 p.m. My producer this week was James Tyndale of Whistledown Productions, and here at Politico, my executive producer is Christina Gonzalez, and my editor is Jack Blanchard. And that's it for this season of Westminster Insider. We're off on our season break for the next few weeks, but we'll be back on the 19th of May. See you then.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.